Of course, the installment plan breaks down eventually, even if you're an assiduous buyer, such as I was. I certainly did my best to keep the manufacturers and the advertising men of America busy, but they were disappointed in me, it seems. Everybody was disappointed in me. But there was one man in particular who was more disappointed in me than anyone, and that was a man who had really made an effort to befriend me and whom I had let down. I think of him and the way he took me on as his assistant so readily and graciously, because later, when I was hiring and firing like a 42-horse caliber revolver, I was betrayed right and left myself. But by that time, I had become so inoculated that it didn't matter a damn. But this man had gone out of his way to show me that he believed in me. He was the editor of a catalog for a great mail-order house. It was an enormous compendium of horseshit which was put out once a year and which took the whole year to make ready. I hadn't the slightest idea what it was all about, and why I dropped into his office that day I don't know, unless it was because I wanted to get warm, as I had been knocking about the docks all day, trying to get a job as a checker or some damn thing. It was cozy in his office, and I made him a long speech so as to get thawed out. I didn't know what job to ask for, just a job, I said. He was a sensitive man, and very kind-hearted. He seemed to guess that I was a writer, or wanted to be a writer, because soon he was asking me what I liked to read, and what was my opinion of this writer and that writer. It just happened that I had a list of books in my pocket, books I was searching for at the public library, and so I brought it out and showed it to him. "Great Scott!" he exclaimed. "Do you really read these books?" I modestly shook my head in the affirmative, and then, as often happened to me when I was touched off by some silly remark like that, I began to talk about Homson's Mysteries, which I had just been reading. From then on, the man was like putty in my hands. When he asked me if I would like to be his assistant, he apologized for offering me such a lowly position. He said I could take my time learning the ins and outs of the job. He was sure it would be a cinch for me. And then he asked me if he couldn't lend me some money, out of his own pocket, until I got paid. Before I could say yes or no, he had fished out a $20 bill and thrust it in my hand. Naturally, I was touched. I was ready to work like a son of a bitch for him. Assistant editor, it sounded quite good, especially to the creditors in the neighborhood. And for a while I was so happy to be eating roast beef and chicken and tenderloins of pork that I pretended I liked the job. Actually, it was difficult for me to keep awake. What I had to learn, I had learned in a week's time. And after that? After that I saw myself doing penal servitude for life. In order to make the best of it, I whiled away the time writing stories and essays and long letters to my friends. Perhaps they thought I was writing up new ideas for the company, because for quite a while nobody paid any attention to me. I thought it was a wonderful job. I had almost the whole day to myself, for my writing, having learned to dispose of the company's work in about an hour's time. I was so enthusiastic about my own private work that I gave orders to my underlings not to disturb me, except at stipulated moments. I was sailing along like a breeze, the company paying me regularly, and the slave drivers doing the work I had mapped out for them, when one day, just when I am in the midst of an important essay on the Antichrist, a man whom I had never seen before walks up to my desk, bends over my shoulder, and in a sarcastic tone of voice begins to read aloud what I had just written. I didn't need to inquire who he was or what he was up to. The only thought in my head was, and that I repeated to myself frantically, "Will I get an extra week's pay?" When it came time to bid goodbye to my benefactor, I felt a little ashamed of myself, particularly when he said right off the bat, like, "I tried to get you an extra week's pay, but they wouldn't hear of it. I wish there was something I could do for you. You're only standing in your own way, you know." "To tell you the truth, I still have the greatest faith in you. But I'm afraid you're going to have a hard time of it for a while. You don't fit in anywhere. Someday you'll make a great writer, I feel sure of it. Well, excuse me," he added, shaking hands with me warmly. "I've got to see the boss. Good luck to you." I felt a bit cut up about the incident. I wished it had been possible to prove to him then and there that his faith was justified. I wished I could have justified myself before the whole world at that moment. I would have jumped off the Brooklyn Bridge if it would have convinced people that I wasn't a heartless son of a bitch. I had a heart as big as a whale, as I was soon to prove, but nobody was examining into my heart. Everybody was being let down hard, not only the installment companies, but the landlord, the butcher, the baker, the gas, water, and electricity devils, everybody. If only I could get to believe in this business of work. To save my life, I couldn't see it. I could only see that people were working their balls off because they didn't know any better. I thought of the speech I had made, which won me the job. In some ways, I was very much like Herr Nagel myself. No telling from minute to minute what I would do. No knowing whether I was a monster or a saint. Like so many wonderful men of our time, Herr Nagel was a desperate man, and it was this very desperation which made him such a likable chap. Hamsun didn't know what to make of this character himself. He knew he existed, and he knew that there was something more to him than a mere buffoon and a mystifier. I think he loved Herr Nagel more than any other character he created. And why? Because Herr Nagel was the unacknowledged saint which every artist is, the man who is ridiculed because his solutions, which are truly profound, seem too simple for the world. No man wants to be an artist. He is driven to it because the world refuses to recognize his proper leadership. Work meant nothing to me, because the real work to be done was being evaded. People regarded me as lazy and shiftless, but on the contrary, I was an exceedingly active individual. Even if it was just hunting for a piece of tail, that was something, and well worthwhile, especially if compared to other forms of activity, such as making buttons or turning screws or even removing appendixes. And why did people listen to me so readily when I applied for a job? Why did they find me entertaining? For the reason, no doubt, that I had always spent my time profitably. I brought them gifts from my hours at the public library, from my idle ramblings through the streets, from my intimate experiences with women, from my afternoons at the burlesque, from my visits to the museum and the art galleries. Had I been a dud, just a poor, honest bugger who wanted to work his balls off for so much a week, they wouldn't have offered me the jobs they did, nor would they have handed me cigars, or taken me to lunch, or lent me money, as they frequently did. I must have had something to offer which perhaps unknowingly they prized beyond horsepower or technical ability. I didn't know myself what it was, because I had neither pride, nor vanity, nor envy. About the big issues I was clear, but confronted by the petty details of life, I was bewildered. I had to witness this same bewilderment on a colossal scale before I could grasp what it was all about. Ordinary men are often quicker in sizing up the practical situation. Their ego is commensurate with the demands made upon it. The world is not very different from what they imagine it to be. But a man who is completely out of step with the rest of the world is either suffering from a colossal inflation of his ego, or else the ego is so submerged as to be practically non-existent. Herr Nagel had to dive off the deep end in search of his true ego. His existence was a mystery, to himself and to everyone else. I couldn't afford to leave things hanging in suspense that way. The mystery was too intriguing. Even if I had to rub myself like a cat against every human being I encountered, I was going to get to the bottom of it. Rub long enough and hard enough, and the spark will come. The hibernation of animals, the suspension of life practiced by certain low forms of life, the marvelous vitality of the bedbug which lies in wait endlessly behind the wallpaper, the trance of the yogi, the catalepsy of the pathologic individual, the mystic's union with the cosmos, the immortality of cellular life, all these things the artist learns in order to awaken the world at the propitious moment. The artist belongs to the X root race of man. He is the spiritual microbe, as it were, which carries over from one root race to another. He is not crushed by misfortune, because he is not part of the physical, racial scheme of things. His appearance is always synchronous with catastrophe and dissolution. He is the cyclical being which lives in the epicycle. The experience which he acquires is never used for personal ends. It serves the larger purpose to which he is geared. Nothing is lost on him, however trifling. If he is interrupted for 25 years in the reading of a book, he can go on from the page where he left off as though nothing had happened in between. Everything that happens in between, which is life to most people, is merely an interruption in his forward round. The eternality of his work, when he expresses himself, is merely the reflection of the automatism of life in which he is obliged to lie dormant, a sleeper on the back of sleep, waiting for the signal which will announce the moment of birth. This is the big issue, and this was always clear to me, even when I denied it. The dissatisfaction which drives one from one word to another, one creation to another, is simply a protest against the futility of postponement. The more awake one becomes, as artistic microbe, the less desire one has to do anything. Fully awake, everything is just, and there is no need to come out of the trance. Action, as expressed in creating a work of art, is a concession to the automatic principle of death. Drowning myself in the Gulf of Mexico, I was able to partake of an active life which would permit the real self to hibernate until I was ripe to be born. I understood it perfectly, though I acted blindly and confusedly. I swam back into the stream of human activity until I got to the source of all action, and there I muscled in, calling myself personnel director of a telegraph company, and allowed the tide of humanity to wash over me, like great white-capped breakers. All this active life, preceding the final act of desperation, led me from doubt to doubt, blinding me more and more to the real self, which, like a continent, choked with the evidences of a great and thriving civilization, had already sunk beneath the surface of the sea. The colossal ego was submerged, and what people observed moving frantically above the surface was the periscope of the soul, searching for its target. Everything that came within range had to be destroyed if I were ever to rise again and ride the waves. This monster which rose now and then to fix its target with deadly aim, which dove again and roved and plundered ceaselessly, would, when the time came, rise for the last time to reveal itself as an ark, would gather unto itself a pair of each kind, and at last, when the floods abated, would settle down on the summit of a lofty mountain peak, thence to open wide its doors, and return to the world what had been preserved from the catastrophe. If I shudder now and then when I think of my active life, if I have nightmares, possibly it is because I think of all the men I robbed and murdered in my day sleep. I did everything which my nature bade me to do. Nature is eternally whispering in one's ear, "If you would survive, you must kill." Being human, you kill not like the animal, but automatically, and the killing is disguised, and its ramifications are endless, so that you kill without even thinking about it. You kill without need. The men who are the most honored are the greatest killers. They believe that they are serving their fellow men, and they are sincere in believing so, but they are heartless murderers, and at moments, when they come awake, they realize their crimes and perform frantic, quixotic acts of goodness in order to expiate their guilt. The goodness of man stinks more than the evil which is in him, for the goodness is not yet acknowledged, not an affirmation of the conscious self. Being pushed over the precipice, it is easy at the last moment to surrender all one's possessions, to turn and extend a last embrace to all who are left behind. How are we to stop the blind rush? How are we to stop the automatic process, each one pushing the other over the precipice? As I sat at my desk, over which I had put up a sign reading, "Do not abandon all hope, ye who enter here," as I sat there saying yes, no, yes, no, I realized with a despair that was turning to white frenzy that I was a puppet in whose hands society had placed a Gatling gun. If I performed a good deed, it was no different, ultimately, than if I had performed a bad deed. I was like an equal sign through which the algebraic swarm of humanity was passing. I was a rather important, active equal sign, like a general in time of war, but no matter how competent I were to become, I could never change into a plus or a minus sign, nor could anyone else, as far as I could determine. Our whole life was built up on this principle of equation. The integers had become symbols which were shuffled about in the interests of death. Pity, despair, passion, hope, courage, These were the temporal refractions caused by looking at equations from varying angles. To stop the endless juggling by turning one's back on it, or by facing it squarely and writing about it, would be no help either. In a hall of mirrors, there is no way to turn your back on yourself. I will not do this. I will do some other thing. Very good. But can you do nothing at all? Can you stop thinking about not doing anything? Can you stop dead, and without thinking, radiate the truth which you know? That was the idea which lodged in the back of my head, and which burned and burned, and perhaps, when I was most expansive, most radiant with energy, most sympathetic, most willing, helpful, sincere, good, it was this fixed idea which was shining through. And automatically I was saying, "Why, don't mention it. Nothing at all, I assure you. No, please don't thank me. It's nothing," etc., etc. From firing the gun so many hundreds of times a day, perhaps I didn't even notice the detonations anymore. Perhaps I thought I was opening pigeon traps and filling the sky with milky white fowl. Did you ever see a synthetic monster on the screen, a Frankenstein, realized in flesh and blood? Can you imagine how he might be trained to pull a trigger and see pigeons flying at the same time? Frankenstein is not a myth. Frankenstein is a very real creation, born of the personal experience of a sensitive human being. The monster is always more real when it does not assume the proportions of flesh and blood. The monster of the screen is nothing compared to the monster of the imagination. Even the existent pathologic monsters who find their way into the police station are but feeble demonstrations of the monstrous reality which the pathologist lives with. But to be the monster and the pathologist at the same time, that is reserved for certain species of men who, disguised as artists, are supremely aware that sleep is an even greater danger than insomnia. In order not to fall asleep, in order not to become victims of that insomnia which is called living, they resort to the drug of putting words together endlessly. This is not an automatic process, they say, because there is always present the illusion that they can stop it at will. But they cannot stop. They have only succeeded in creating an illusion, which is perhaps a feeble something, but it is far from being wide awake, and neither active nor inactive. I wanted to be wide awake without talking or writing about it, in order to accept life absolutely. I mentioned the archaic men in the remote places of the world with whom I was communicating frequently. Why did I think these savages more capable of understanding me than the men and women who surrounded me? Was I crazy to believe such a thing? I don't think so in the least. These savages are the degenerate remnants of earlier races of man, who I believe must have had a greater hold on reality. The immortality of the race is constantly before our eyes in these specimens of the past who linger on in withered splendor. Whether the human race is immortal or not is not my concern, but the vitality of the race does mean something to me, and that it should be active or dormant means even more. As the vitality of the new race banks down, the vitality of the old races manifests itself to the waking mind with greater and greater significance. The vitality of the old races lingers on even in death, but the vitality of the new race, which is about to die, seems already non-existent. If a man were taking a swarming hive of bees to the river to drown them, that was the image I carried about in me. If only I were the man and not the bee. In some vague, inexplicable way, I knew that I was the man, that I would not be drowned in the hive like the others. Always, when we came forward in a group, I was signaled to stand apart. From birth I was favored that way, and no matter what tribulations I went through, I knew they were not fatal or lasting. Also, another strange thing took place in me whenever I was called to stand forth. I knew that I was superior to the man who was summoning me. The tremendous humility which I practiced was not hypocritical, but a condition provoked by the realization of the fateful character of the situation. The intelligence which I possessed, even as a stripling, frightened me. It was the intelligence of a savage, which is always superior to that of civilized men, in that it is more adequate to the exigencies of circumstance. It is a life intelligence, even though life has seemingly passed them by. I felt almost as if I had been shot forward into a round of existence which for the rest of mankind had not yet attained its full rhythm. I was obliged to mark time if I were to remain with them and not to be shunted off to another sphere of existence. On the other hand, I was in many ways lower than the human beings about me. It was as though I had come out of the fires of hell, not entirely purged. I had still a tail and a pair of horns, and when my passions were aroused, I breathed a sulphurous poison which was annihilating. I was always called a lucky devil. The good that happened to me was called luck, and the evil was always regarded as a result of my shortcomings, rather as the fruit of my blindness. Rarely did anyone ever spot the evil in me. I was as adroit in this respect as the devil himself, but that I was frequently blind, everybody could see that, and at such times I was left alone, shunned, like the devil himself. Then I left the world, returned to the fires of hell, voluntarily. These comings and goings are as real to me, more real in fact, than anything that happened in between. The friends who think they know nothing about me for the reason that the real me changed hands countless times. Neither the men who thanked me, nor the men who cursed me, knew with whom they were dealing. Nobody ever got on to a solid footing with me, because I was constantly liquidating my personality. I was keeping what is called the personality in abeyance for the moment when, leaving it to coagulate, it would adopt a proper human rhythm. I was hiding my face until the moment when I would find myself in step with the world. All this was, of course, a mistake. Even the role of artist is worth adopting while marking time. Action is important, even if it entails futile activity. One should not say yes, no, even seated in the highest place. One should not be drowned in the human tidal wave, even for the sake of becoming a master. One must beat with his own rhythm, at any price. I accumulated thousands of years of experience, in a few short years, but the experience was wasted, because I had no need of it. I had already been crucified and marked by the cross. I had been born free of the need to suffer, and yet I knew no other way to struggle forward than to repeat the drama. All my intelligence was against it. Suffering is futile, my intelligence told me over and over, but I went on suffering, voluntarily. Suffering has never taught me a thing. For others it may still be necessary, but for me it is nothing more than an algebraic demonstration of spiritual inadaptability. The whole drama which the man of today is acting out through suffering does not exist for me. It never did, actually. All my Calvaries were rosy crucifixions, pseudo-tragedies to keep the fires of hell burning brightly for the real sinners who are in danger of being forgotten. Another thing. The mystery which enveloped my behavior grew deeper the nearer I came to the circle of uterine relatives. The mother from whose loins I sprang was a complete stranger to me. To begin with, after giving birth to me, she gave birth to my sister, whom I usually refer to as my brother. My sister was a sort of harmless monster, an angel who had been given the body of an idiot. It gave me a strange feeling, as a boy, to be growing up and developing side by side with this being who was doomed to remain all her life a mental dwarf. It was impossible to be a brother to her, because it was impossible to regard this atavistic hulk of a body as a sister. She would have functioned perfectly, I imagine, among the Australian primitives. She might even have been raised to power and eminence among them, for, as I said, she was the essence of goodness. She knew no evil. But so far as living the civilized life goes, she was helpless. She not only had no desire to kill, but she had no desire to thrive at the expense of others. She was incapacitated for work, because even if they had been able to train her to make caps for high explosives, for example, she might absent-mindedly throw her wages in the river on the way home, or she might give them to a beggar in the street. Often in my presence, she was whipped like a dog for having performed some beautiful act of grace in her absent-mindedness, as they called it. Nothing was worse, I learned as a child, than to do a good deed without reason. I had received the same punishment as my sister in the beginning, because I too had a habit of giving things away, especially new things which had just been given me. I had even received a beating once, at the age of 5, for having advised my mother to cut a wart off her finger. She had asked me what to do about it one day, and with my limited knowledge of medicine, I told her to cut it off with the scissors, which she did, like an idiot. A few days later she got blood poisoning, and then she got hold of me and she said, "You told me to cut it off, didn't you?" And she gave me a sound thrashing. From that day on I knew that I was born in the wrong household. From that day on, I learned like lightning. Talk about adaptation. By the time I was 10, I had lived out the whole theory of evolution. And there I was, evolving through all the phases of animal life, and yet chained to this creature called my sister, who was evidently a primitive being, and who would never, even at the age of 90, arrive at a comprehension of the alphabet. Instead of growing up like a stalwart tree, I began to lean to one side, in complete defiance of the law of gravity. Instead of shooting out limbs and leaves, I grew windows and turrets. The whole being, as it grew, was turning into stone, and the higher I shot up, the more I defied the law of gravity. I was a phenomenon in the midst of the landscape, but one which attracted people and elicited praise. If the mother who bore us had only made another effort, perhaps a marvelous white buffalo might have been born, and the three of us might have been permanently installed in a museum and protected for life. The conversations which took place between the Leaning Tower of Pisa, the Whipping Post, the Snoring Machine, and the pterodactyl in human flesh were, to say the least, a bit queer. Anything might be the subject of conversation, a breadcrumb which the sister had overlooked in brushing the tablecloth, or Joseph's coat of many colors which, in the old man's tailoring brain, might have been either double-breasted or cutaway or frock. If I came from the ice pond where I'd been skating all afternoon, the important thing was not the ozone which I had breathed free of charge, nor the geometric convolutions which were strengthening my muscles, but the little spot of rust under the clamps, which, if not rubbed off immediately, might deteriorate the whole skate and bring about the dissolution of some pragmatic value which was incomprehensible to my prodigal turn of thought. This little rust spot, to take a trifling example, might entrain the most hallucinating results. Perhaps the sister, in searching for the kerosene can, might overturn the jar of prunes which were being stewed and thus endanger all our lives by robbing us of the required calories in the morrow's meal. A severe beating would have to be given, not in anger, because that would disturb the digestive apparatus, but silently and efficiently, as a chemist would beat up the white of an egg in preparation for a minor analysis. But the sister, not understanding the prophylactic nature of the punishment, would give vent to the most blood-curdling screams, and this would so affect the old man that he would go out for a walk and return 2 or 3 hours later blind drunk, and what was worse, scratching a little paint off the rolling doors in his blind staggers. The little piece of paint that had been chipped off would bring on a battle royal, which was very bad for my dream life, because in my dream life I frequently changed places with my sister, accepting the tortures inflicted upon her and nourishing them with my supersensitive brain. It was in these dreams, always accompanied by the sound of glass breaking, of shrieks, curses, groans, and sobs, that I gathered an unformulated knowledge of the ancient mysteries, of the rites of initiation, of the transmigration of souls, and so on. It might begin with a scene from real life, the sister standing by the blackboard in the kitchen, the mother towering over her with a ruler, saying 2 and 2 makes how much? And the sister screaming, 5, bang, no, 7, bang, no, 13, 18, 20. I would be sitting at the table, doing my lessons, just as in real life during these scenes, when by a slight twist or squirm, perhaps as I saw the ruler come down on the sister's face, suddenly I would be in another realm, where glass was unknown, as it was unknown to the Kickapoos, or the Lenni Lenape. The faces of those about me were familiar. They were my uterine relatives, who for some mysterious reason failed to recognize me in this new ambiance. They were garbed in black, and the color of their skin was ash gray. like that of the Tibetan devils. They were all fitted out with knives and other instruments of torture. They belonged to the caste of sacrificial butchers. I seemed to have absolute liberty and the authority of a god, and yet by some capricious turn of events, the end would be that I'd be lying on the sacrificial block, and one of my charming uterine relatives would be bending over me with a gleaming knife to cut out my heart. In sweat and terror I would begin to recite my lessons in a high, screaming voice, faster and faster as I felt the knife searching for my heart. 2 and 2 is 4, 5 and 5 is 10, earth, air, fire, water, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, miocene, pliocene, eocene, the Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost, Asia, Africa, Europe, Australia, red, blue, yellow, the sorrel, the persimmon, the pawpaw, the catalpa, faster and faster. Odin, Wotan, Parsifal, King Alfred, Frederick the Great, the Hanseatic League, the Battle of Hastings, Thermopylae, 1492, 1776, 1812, Admiral Farragut, Pickett's Charge, the Light Brigade, we are gathered here today, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not, one and indivisible, no, 16, no, 27, help, murder, police, and yelling louder and louder and going faster and faster, I go completely off my nut, and there is no more pain, no more terror, even though they are piercing me everywhere with knives. Suddenly, I am absolutely calm, and the body which is lying on the block, which they are still gouging with glee and ecstasy, feels nothing because I, the owner of it, have escaped. I have become a tower of stone which leans over the scene and watches with scientific interest. I have only to succumb to the law of gravity, and I will fall on them and obliterate them. But I do not succumb to the law of gravity, because I am too fascinated by the horror of it all. I am so fascinated, in fact, that I grow more and more windows. And as the light penetrates the stone interior of my being, I can feel that my roots, which are in the earth, are alive, and that I shall one day be able to remove myself at will from this trance in which I am fixed. So much for the dream, in which I am helplessly rooted. But in actuality, when the dear uterine relatives come, I am as free as a bird, and darting to and fro like a magnetic needle. If they ask me a question, I give them 5 answers, each of which is better than the other. If they ask me to play a waltz, I play a double-breasted sonata for the left hand. If they ask me to help myself to another leg of chicken, I clean up the plate, dressing and all. If they urge me to go out and play in the street, I go out, and in my enthusiasm, I cut my cousin's head open with a tin can. If they threaten to give me a thrashing, I say, go to it, I don't mind. If they pat me on the head for my good progress at school, I spit on the floor, to show that I have still something to learn. I do everything they wish me to do, plus. If they wish me to be quiet and say nothing, I become as quiet as a rock. I don't hear when they speak to me, I don't move when I'm touched, I don't cry when I'm pinched, I don't budge when I'm pushed. If they complain that I'm stubborn, I become as pliant and yielding as rubber. If they wish to get me fatigued so that I will not display too much energy, I let them give me all kinds of work to do, and I do the job so thoroughly that I collapse on the floor finally, like a sack of wheat. If they wish me to be reasonable, I become ultra-reasonable, which drives them crazy. If they wish me to obey, I obey to the letter, which causes endless confusion. And all this because the molecular life of brother and sister is incompatible with the atomic weights which have been allotted us. Because she doesn't grow at all, I grow like a mushroom. Because she has no personality, I become a colossus. Because she is free of evil, I become a 32-branched candelabra of evil. Because she demands nothing of anyone, I demand everything. Because she inspires ridicule everywhere, I inspire fear and respect. Because she is humiliated and tortured, I wreak vengeance upon everyone, friend and foe alike. Because she is helpless, I make myself all-powerful. The gigantism from which I suffered was simply the result of an effort to wipe out the little stain of rust which had attached itself to the family skate, so to speak. That little stain of rust under the clamps made me a champion skater. It made me skate so fast and furiously that even when the ice had melted, I was still skating, skating through mud, through asphalt, through brooks and rivers and melon patches and theories of economics and so forth. I could skate through hell, I was that fast and nimble. But all this fancy skating was of no use. Father Coxcox, the Pan-American Noah, was always calling me back to the Ark. Every time I stopped skating, there was a cataclysm. The earth opened up and swallowed me. I was a brother to every man and at the same time a traitor to myself. I made the most astounding sacrifices, only to find that they were of no value. Of what use was it to prove that I could be what was expected of me, when I did not want to be any of these things? Every time you come to the limit of what is demanded of you, you are faced with the same problem, to be yourself. And with the first step you make in this direction, you realize that there is neither plus nor minus. You throw the skates away and swim. There is no suffering anymore because there is nothing which can threaten your security, and there is no desire to be of help to others even, because why rob them of a privilege which must be earned? Life stretches out from moment to moment in stupendous infinitude. Nothing can be more real than what you suppose it to be. Whatever you think the cosmos to be, it is, and it could not possibly be anything else as long as you are you, and I am I. You live in the fruits of your action, and your action is the harvest of your thought. Thought and action are one, because swimming you are in it and of it, and it is everything you desire it to be, no more, no less. Every stroke counts for eternity. The heating and cooling system is one system, and Cancer is separated from Capricorn only by an imaginary line. You don't become ecstatic, and you are not plunged into violent grief. You don't pray for rain, neither do you dance a jig. You live like a happy rock in the midst of the ocean. You are fixed, while everything about you is in turbulent motion. You are fixed in a reality which permits the thought that nothing is fixed, that even the happiest and mightiest rock will one day be utterly dissolved and fluid as the ocean from which it was born. This is the musical life which I was approaching by first skating like a maniac through all the vestibules and corridors which led from the outer to the inner. My struggles never brought me near it, nor did my furious activity, nor my rubbing elbows with humanity. All that was simply a movement from vector to vector in a circle which, however the perimeter expanded, remained withal parallel to the realm I speak of. The wheel of destiny can be transcended at any moment because at every point of its surface it touches the real world, and only a spark of illumination is necessary to bring about the miraculous, to transform the skater to a swimmer and the swimmer to a rock. The rock is merely an image of the act which stops the futile rotation of the wheel and plunges the being into full consciousness. And full consciousness is indeed like an inexhaustible ocean which gives itself to sun and moon and also includes the sun and moon. Everything which is born out of the limitless ocean of light, even the night. Sometimes, in the ceaseless revolutions of the wheel, I caught a glimpse of the nature of the jump which it was necessary to make. To jump clear of the clockwork, that was the liberating thought. To be something more, something different than the most brilliant maniac of the earth. The story of man on earth bored me. Conquest, even the conquest of evil, bored me. To radiate goodness is marvelous, because it is tonic, invigorating, vitalizing. But just to be is still more marvelous, because it is endless and requires no demonstration. To be is music, which is a profanation of silence in the interest of silence, and therefore beyond good and evil. Music is the manifestation of action without activity. It is the pure act of creation swimming on its own bosom. Music neither goads nor defends, neither seeks nor explains. Music is the noiseless sound made by the swimmer in the ocean of consciousness. It is a reward which can only be given by oneself. It is the gift of the God which one is, because he has ceased thinking about God. It is an augur of the God which everyone will become in due time, when all that is will be beyond imagination. Coda. Not long ago, I was walking the streets of New York. Dear old Broadway. It was night, and the sky was an oriental blue as the gold in the ceiling of the pagode, Rue de Babylon, when the machine starts clicking. I was passing exactly below the place where we first met. I stood there a moment, looking up at the red lights in the windows. The music sounded as it always sounded, light, peppery, enchanting. I was alone, and there were millions of people around me. It came over me as I stood there that I wasn't thinking of her anymore. I was thinking of this book which I am writing, and the book had become more important to me than her, than all that had happened to us. Will this book be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God? Plunging into the crowd again, I wrestled with this question of truth. For years I have been trying to tell this story, and always the question of truth has weighed upon me like a nightmare. Time and again I have related to others the circumstances of our life, and I have always told the truth. But the truth can also be a lie. The truth is not enough. Truth is only the core of a totality which is inexhaustible. I remember that the first time we were ever separated, this idea of totality seized me by the hair. She pretended when she left me, or maybe she believed it herself, that it was necessary for our welfare. I knew in my heart that she was trying to be free of me, but I was too cowardly to admit it to myself. But when I realized that she could do without me, even for a limited time, the truth which I had tried to shut out began to grow with alarming rapidity. It was more painful than anything I had ever experienced before, but it was also healing. When I was completely emptied, when the loneliness had reached such a point that it could not be sharpened any further, I suddenly felt that, to go on living, this intolerable truth had to be incorporated into something greater than the frame of personal misfortune. I felt that I had made an imperceptible switch into another realm, a realm of tougher, more elastic fiber, which the most horrible truth was powerless to destroy. I sat down to write her a letter, telling her that I was so miserable over the thought of losing her that I had decided to begin a book about her, a book which would immortalize her. It would be a book, I said, such as no one had ever seen before. I rambled on ecstatically, and in the midst of it, I suddenly broke off to ask myself why I was so happy. Passing beneath the dance hall, thinking again of this book, I realized suddenly that our life had come to an end. I realized that the book I was planning was nothing more than a tomb in which to bury her, and the me which had belonged to her. That was some time ago, and ever since I have been trying to write it. Why is it so difficult? Why? Because the idea of an end is intolerable to me. Truth lies in this knowledge of the end, which is ruthless and remorseless. We can know the truth and accept it, or we can refuse the knowledge of it and neither die nor be born again. In this manner, it is possible to live forever, a negative life as solid and complete, or as dispersed and fragmentary as the atom. And if we pursue this road far enough, even this atomic eternity can yield to nothingness, and the universe itself fall apart. For years now I have been trying to tell this story. Each time I have started out, I have chosen a different route. I am like an explorer who, wishing to circumnavigate the globe, deems it unnecessary to carry even a compass. Moreover, from dreaming over it so long, the story itself has come to resemble a vast, fortified city, and I, who dream it over and over, am outside the city, a wanderer, arriving before one gate after another, too exhausted to enter. And as with the wanderer, this city in which my story is situated eludes me perpetually. Always in sight, it nevertheless remains unattainable, a sort of ghostly citadel, floating in the clouds. From the soaring, crenellated battlements, flocks of huge white geese swoop down in steady, wedge-shaped formation. With the tips of their blue-white wings, they brush the dreams that dazzle my vision. My feet move confusedly. No sooner do I gain a foothold than I am lost again. I wander aimlessly, trying to gain a solid, unshakable foothold whence I can command a view of my life, but behind me there lies only a welter of crisscrossed tracks, a groping, confused encircling, the spasmodic gambit of the chicken whose head has just been lopped off. Whenever I try to explain to myself the peculiar pattern which my life has taken, when I reach back to the first cause, as it were, I think inevitably of the girl I first loved. It seems to me that everything dates from that aborted affair. A strange, masochistic affair it was, ridiculous and tragic at the same time. Perhaps I had the pleasure of kissing her two or three times, the sort of kiss one reserves for a goddess. Perhaps I saw her alone several times. Certainly she could never have dreamed that for over a year I walked past her home every night, hoping to catch a glimpse of her at the window. Every night after dinner I would get up from the table and take the long route which led to her home. She was never at the window when I passed, and I never had the courage to stand in front of the house and wait. Back and forth I passed, back and forth, but never hide nor hair of her. Why didn't I write her? Why didn't I call her up? Once I remember summoning enough pluck to invite her to the theater. I arrived at her home with a bunch of violets, the first and only time I ever bought flowers for a woman. As we were leaving the theater, the violets dropped from her corsage, and in my confusion I stepped on them. I begged her to leave them there, but she insisted on gathering them up. I was thinking how awkward I was. It was only long afterwards that I recalled the smile she had given me as she stooped down to pick up the violets. It was a complete fiasco. In the end, I ran away. Actually, I was running away from another woman, but the day before leaving town, I decided to see her once again. It was mid-afternoon, and she came out to talk to me in the street, in the little areaway which was fenced off. She was already engaged to another man. She pretended to be happy about it, but I could see, blind as I was, that she wasn't as happy as she pretended to be. If I had only said the word, I am sure she would have dropped the other fellow. Perhaps she would even have gone away with me. I preferred to punish myself. I said goodbye nonchalantly, and I went down the street like a dead man. The next morning I was bound for the coast, determined to start a new life. The new life was also a fiasco. I ended up on a ranch in Chula Vista, the most miserable man that ever walked the earth. There was this girl I loved, and there was the other woman, for whom I felt only a profound pity. I had been living with her for 2 years, this other woman, but it seemed like a lifetime. I was 21, and she admitted to be 36. Every time I looked at her, I said to myself, "When I am 30, she will be 45. When I am 40, she will be 55. When I am 50, she will be 65. She had fine wrinkles under the eyes, laughing wrinkles, but wrinkles just the same. When I kissed her, they were magnified a dozen times. She laughed easily, but her eyes were sad, terribly sad. They were Armenian eyes. Her hair, which had been red once, was now a peroxide blonde. Otherwise, she was adorable. A Venusian body, a Venusian soul, loyal, lovable, grateful, everything a woman should be, except that she was 15 years older. The 15 years difference drove me crazy. When I went out with her, I thought only, how will it be 10 years hence? Or else, what age does she seem to have now? Do I look old enough for her? Once we got back to the house, it was all right. Climbing the stairs, I would run my finger up her crotch, which used to make her whinny like a horse. If her son, who was almost my age, were in bed, we would close the doors and lock ourselves in the kitchen. She'd lie on the narrow kitchen table, and I'd slough it into her. It was marvelous. And what made it more marvelous was that with each performance I would say to myself, "This is the last time. Tomorrow I will beat it." And then, since she was the janitress, I would go down to the cellar and roll the ash barrels out for her. In the morning, when the sun had left for work, I would climb up to the roof and air the bedding. Both she and the sun had TB. Sometimes there were no table bouts. Sometimes the hopelessness of it all got me by the throat, and I would put on my things and go for a walk. Now and then I forgot to return. And when I did that, I was more miserable than ever, because I knew that she would be waiting for me with those large, sorrowful eyes. I'd go back to her like a man who had a sacred duty to perform. I'd lie down on the bed and let her caress me. I'd study the wrinkles under her eyes and the roots of her hair, which were turning red. Lying there like that, I would often think about the other one, the one I loved. Would wonder if she were lying down for it, too. Or those long walks I took 365 days of the year. I would go over them in my mind, lying beside the other woman. How many times since have I relived these walks? The dreariest, bleakest, ugliest streets man ever created. In anguish I relive these walks, these streets, these first smashed hopes. The window is there, but no Melisande. The garden, too, is there, but no sheen of gold. Pass and repass, the window always vacant. The evening star hangs low. Tristan appears, then Fidelio, and then Oberon. The hydra-headed dog barks with all his mouths, and though there are no swamps, I hear the frogs croaking everywhere. Same houses, same car lines, same everything. She is hiding behind the curtain. She is waiting for me to pass. She is doing this or doing that, but she is not there. Never, never, never. Is it a grand opera, or is it a hurdy-gurdy playing? It is a motto bursting his golden lung. It is the Rubaiyat. It is Mount Everest. It is a moonless night. It is a sob at dawn. It is a boy making believe. It is Puss in the Boot. It is Mauna Loa. It is fox or astrakhan. It is of no stuff and no time. It is endless, and it begins over and over, under the heart, in the back of the throat, in the soles of the feet, and why not just once for the love of Christ, just a shadow or a rustle of the curtain or a breath on the window pane, something once, if only a lie, something to stop the pain, to stop this walking up and down. Walking homeward, same houses, same lampposts, same everything. I walk past my own home, past the cemetery, past the gas tanks, past the car barns, past the reservoir, out into the open country. I sit beside the road with my head in my hands and sob. Poor bugger that I am, I can't contract my heart enough to burst the veins. I would like to suffocate with grief, but instead, I give birth to a rock. Meanwhile, the other one is waiting. I can see her again, as she sat on the low stoop waiting for me. Her eyes large and dolorous, her face pale and trembling with eagerness. Pity, I always thought it was, brought me back. But now as I walk toward her and see the look in her eyes, I don't know any more what it is, only that we will go inside and lie together, and she will get up, half weeping, half laughing, and she will grow very silent and watch me, study me as I move about, and never ask me what is torturing me, never. Never, because that is the one thing she fears, the one thing she dreads to know. I don't love you. Can't she hear me screaming it? I don't love you. Over and over I yell it, with lips tight, with hatred in my heart, with despair, with hopeless rage. But the words never leave my lips. I look at her, and I am tongue-tied. I can't do it. Time, time, endless time on our hands, and nothing to fill it but lies. Well, I don't want to rehearse the whole of my life leading up to the fatal moment. It is too long and too painful. Besides, did my life really lead up to this culminating moment? I doubt it. I think there were innumerable moments when I had the chance to make a beginning, but I lacked the strength and the faith. On the evening in question, I deliberately walked out on myself. I walked right out of the old life and into the new. There wasn't the slightest effort involved. I was 30 then. I had a wife and child and what is called a responsible position. These are the facts, and facts mean nothing. The truth is, my desire was so great, it became a reality. At such a moment, what a man does is of no great importance. It's what he is that counts. It's at such a moment that a man becomes an angel. That is precisely what happened to me. I became an angel. It is not the purity of an angel which is so valuable as the fact it can fly. An angel can break the pattern anywhere at any moment and find its heaven. It has the power to descend into the lowest matter and to extricate itself at will. The night in question, I understood it perfectly. I was pure and inhuman. I was detached. I had wings. I was depossessed of the past, and I had no concern about the future. I was beyond ecstasy. When I left the office, I folded my wings and hid them beneath my coat. The dance hall was just opposite the side entrance of the theater where I used to sit in the afternoons instead of looking for work. It was a street of theaters, and I used to sit there for hours at a time, dreaming the most violent dreams. The whole theatrical life of New York was concentrated in that one street, so it seemed. It was Broadway. It was success, fame, glitter, paint, the asbestos curtain, and the hole in the curtain. Sitting on the steps of the theater, I used to stare at the dance hall opposite, at the string of red lanterns which even in the summer afternoons were lit up. In every window there was a spinning ventilator which seemed to waft the music into the street, where it was broken by the jangled din of traffic. Opposite the other side of the dance hall was a comfort station, and here, too, I used to sit, now and then, hoping either to make a woman or make a touch. Above the comfort station, on the street level, was a kiosk with foreign papers and magazines. The very sight of these papers, of the strange languages in which they were printed, was sufficient to dislocate me for the day. Without the slightest premeditation, I climbed the stairs to the dance hall, went directly to the little window of the booth where Nick, the Greek, sat with a roll of tickets in front of him. Like the urinal below and the steps of the theater, this hand of the Greek now seems to me a separate and detached thing, the enormous, hairy hand of an ogre borrowed from some horrible Scandinavian fairy tale. It was the hand which spoke to me always, the hand which said, "Miss Mara will not be here tonight," or, "Yes, Miss Mara is coming late tonight." It was this hand which I dreamt of as a child when I slept in the bedroom with the barred window. In my fevered sleep, suddenly this window would light up to reveal the ogre clutching at the bars. Night after night, the hairy monster visited me, clutching at the bars and gnashing its teeth. I would awake in a cold sweat, the house dark, the room absolutely silent. Standing at the edge of the dance floor, I notice her coming toward me. She is coming with sails spread, the large, full face beautifully balanced on the long, columnar neck. I see a woman perhaps 18, perhaps 30, with blue-black hair and a large white face, a full white face, in which the eyes shine brilliantly. She has on a tailored blue suit of duvetyn. I remember distinctly now the fullness of her body, and that her hair was fine and straight, parted on the side, like a man's. I remember the smile she gave me, knowing, mysterious, fugitive, a smile that sprang up suddenly, like a puff of wind. The whole being was concentrated in the face. I could have taken just the head and walked home with it. I could have put it beside me at night on a pillow and made love to it. The mouth and the eyes, when they opened up, the whole being glowed from them. There was an illumination which came from some unknown source, from a center hidden deep in the earth. I could think of nothing but the face, the strange, womb-like quality of the smile, the engulfing immediacy of it. The smile was so painfully swift and fleeting that it was like the flash of a knife. This smile, this face, was borne aloft on a long white neck, the sturdy, swan-like neck of the medium, and of the lost and the damned. I stand on the corner, under the red lights, waiting for her to come down. It is about 2 in the morning, and she is signing off. I am standing on Broadway, with a flower in my buttonhole, feeling absolutely clean and alone. Almost the whole evening, we have been talking about Strindberg, about a character of his named Henriette. I listened with such tense alertness that I fell into a trance. It was as if, with the opening phrase, we had started on a race, in opposite directions. Henriette. Almost immediately the name was mentioned, she began to talk about herself, without ever quite losing hold of Henriette. Henriette was attached to her by a long, invisible string which she manipulated imperceptibly with one finger, like the street hawker who stands a little removed from the black cloth on the sidewalk, apparently indifferent to the little mechanism which is jiggling on the cloth, but betraying himself by the spasmodic movement of the little finger to which the black thread is attached. "Henriette is me, my real self," she seemed to be saying. She wanted me to believe that Henriette was really the incarnation of evil. She said it so naturally, so innocently, with an almost subhuman candor. How was I to believe that she meant it? I could only smile, as though to show her I was convinced. Suddenly I feel her coming. I turn my head. Yes, there she is, coming full on. The sails spread, the eyes glowing. For the first time I see now what a carriage she has. She comes forward like a bird, a human bird wrapped in a soft fur. The engine is going full steam. I want to shout, to give a blast that will make the whole world cock its ears. What a walk! It's not a walk, it's a glide. Tall, stately, full-bodied, self-possessed, she cuts the smoke and jazz and red-light glow like the queen mother of all the slippery Babylonian whores. On the corner of Broadway, just opposite the comfort station, this is happening. Broadway. It's her realm. This is Broadway. This is New York. This is America. She's America, on foot, winged and sexed. She is the Lubette, the abominate, and the sublimate, with a dash of hydrochloric acid, nitroglycerin, laudanum, and powdered onyx. Opulence she has, and magnificence. It's America, right or wrong, and the ocean on either side. For the first time in my life, the whole continent hits me full force, hits me between the eyes. This is America. Buffaloes or no buffaloes, America the emery wheel of hope and disillusionment. Whatever made America made her, bone, blood, muscle, eyeball, gait, rhythm, poise, confidence, brass, and hollow gut. She's almost on top of me. The full face, gleaming like calcium. The big, soft fur is slipping from her shoulder. She doesn't notice it. She doesn't seem to care if her clothes should drop off. She doesn't give a fuck about anything. It's America, moving like a streak of lightning toward the glass warehouse of red-blooded hysteria. America, fur or no fur, shoes or no shoes, America COD, and scram, you bastards, before we plug you. It's got me in the guts. I'm quaking. Something's coming to me, and there's no dodging it. She's coming head-on, through the plate-glass window. If she would only stop a second, if she would only let me be for just one moment, but no, not a single moment does she grant me. Swift, ruthless, imperious, like fate itself she is on me, a sword cutting me through and through. She has me by the hand, she holds it tight. I walk beside her without fear. Inside me the stars are twinkling. Inside me a great blue vault where a moment ago the engines were pounding furiously. One can wait a whole lifetime for a moment like this. The woman whom you never hope to meet now sits before you, and she talks and looks exactly like the person you dreamed about. But strangest of all is that you never realized before that you had dreamed about her. Your whole past is like a long sleep which would have been forgotten had there been no dream. And the dream, too, might have been forgotten had there been no memory, but remembrance is there in the blood, and the blood is like an ocean in which everything is washed away but that which is new and more substantial even than life. Reality. We are seated in a little booth in the Chinese restaurant across the way. Out of the corner of my eye I catch the flicker of the illuminated letters running up and down the sky. She is still talking about Henriette, or maybe it is about herself. Her little black bonnet, her bag and fur are lying beside her on the bench. Every few minutes she lights a fresh cigarette, which burns away as she talks. There is no beginning nor end. It spurts out of her like a flame and consumes everything within reach. No knowing how or where she began. Suddenly she is in the midst of a long narrative, a fresh one, but it is always the same. Her talk is as formless as dream. There are no grooves, no walls, no exits, no stops. I have the feeling of being drowned in a deep mesh of words, of crawling painfully back to the top of the net, of looking into her eyes and trying to find there some reflection of the significance of her words, but I can find nothing. Nothing except my own image, wavering in a bottomless well. Though she speaks of nothing but herself, I am unable to form the slightest image of her being. She leans forward, with elbows on the table, and her words inundate me. Wave after wave rolling over me, and yet nothing builds up inside me, nothing that I can seize with my mind. She's telling me about her father, about the strange life they led at the edge of Sherwood Forest where she was born. Or at least she was telling me about this, but now it's about Henriette again. Or is it Dostoevsky? I'm not sure. But anyway, suddenly, I realize that she's not talking about any of these anymore, but about a man who took her home one night. And as they stood on the stoop saying good night, he suddenly reached down and pulled up her dress. She pauses a moment as though to reassure me that this is what she means to talk about. I look at her bewilderedly. I can't imagine by what route we got to this point. What man? What had he been saying to her? I let her continue, thinking that she will probably come back to it, but no, she's ahead of me again, and now it seems the man, this man, is already dead, a suicide, and she is trying to make me understand that it was an awful blow to her. But what she really seems to convey is that she is proud of the fact that she drove a man to suicide. I can't picture the man as dead. I can only think of him as he stood on her stoop, lifting her dress, a man without a name but alive and perpetually fixed in the act of bending down to lift up her dress. There is another man who was her father, and I see him with a string of racehorses, or sometimes in a little inn just outside Vienna. Rather, I see him on the roof of the inn, flying kites to while the time away. And between this man who was her father and the man with whom she was madly in love, I can make no separation. He is someone in her life about whom she would rather not talk. But just the same, she comes back to him all the time, and though I'm not sure that it was not the man who lifted up her dress, neither am I sure that it wasn't the man who committed suicide. Perhaps it's the man whom she started to talk about when we sat down to eat. Just as we were sitting down, I remember now that she began to talk rather hectically about a man whom she had just seen entering the cafeteria. She even mentioned his name, but I forgot it immediately. But I remember her saying that she had lived with him, and that he had done something which she didn't like, she didn't say what, and so she had walked out on him, left him flat, without a word of explanation. And then, just as we were entering the chop suey joint, they ran into each other, and she was still trembling over it as we sat down in the little booth. For one long moment I have the most uneasy sensation. Maybe every word she uttered was a lie. Not an ordinary lie, no, something worse, something indescribable. Only sometimes the truth comes out like that, too, especially if you think you're never going to see the person again. Sometimes you can tell a perfect stranger what you would never dare reveal to your most intimate friend. It's like going to sleep in the midst of a party. You become so interested in yourself that you go to sleep. And when you're sound asleep, you begin to talk to someone, someone who is in the same room with you all the time, and therefore understands everything, even though you begin in the middle of a sentence. And perhaps this other person goes to sleep also, or was always asleep, and that's why it was so easy to encounter him. And if he doesn't say anything to disturb you, then you know that what you are saying is real and true, and that you are wide awake, and there is no other reality except this being wide awake asleep. Never before have I been so wide awake and so sound asleep at the same time. If the ogre in my dreams had really pushed the bars aside and taken me by the hand, I would have been frightened to death, and consequently now dead, that is, forever asleep, and therefore always at large, and nothing would be strange any more, nor untrue, even if what happened did not happen. What happened must have happened long ago, in the night, undoubtedly. And what is now happening is also happening long ago, in the night. And this is no more true than the dream of the ogre and the bars which would not give, except that now the bars are broken, and she whom I feared has me by the hand, and there is no difference between that which I feared and what is, because I was asleep, and now I am wide awake asleep, and there is nothing more to fear, nor to expect, nor to hope for, but just this which is, and which knows no end. She wants to go. To go. Again her haunch, that slippery glide as when she came down from the dance hall and moved into me. Again her words. Suddenly, for no reason at all, he bent down and lifted up my dress. She's slipping the fur around her neck. The little black bonnet sets her face off like a cameo. The round, full face with Slavic cheekbones. How could I dream this, never having seen it? How could I know that she would rise like this, close and full, the face full white and blooming like a magnolia? I tremble as the fullness of her thigh brushes me. She seems even a little taller than I, though she is not. It's the way she holds her chin. She doesn't notice where she's walking. She walks over things, on, with eyes wide open and staring into space. No past, no future. Even the present seems dubious. The self seems to have left her, and the body rushes forward, the neck full and taut, white as the face, full like the face. The talk goes on, in that low, throaty voice. No beginning, no end. I'm aware not of time, nor the passing of time, but of timelessness. She's got the little womb in the throat hooked up to the big womb in the pelvis. The cab is at the curb, and she is still chewing the cosmological chaff of the outer ego. I pick up the speaking tube and connect with the double uterus. Hello? Hello, are you there? Let's go. Let's get on with it. Cabs, boats, trains, naphtha launches, beaches, bedbugs, highways, byways, ruins, relics, old world, new world, pier, jetty, the high forceps, the swinging trapeze, the ditch, the delta, the alligators, the crocodiles, talk, talk and more talk, then roads again, and more dust in the eyes, more rainbows, more cloudbursts, more breakfast foods, more creams, more lotions. And when all the roads have been traversed, and there is left only the dust of our frantic feet, there will still remain the memory of your large, full face, so white, and the wide mouth with fresh lips parted, the teeth chalk-white and each one perfect, and in this remembrance nothing can possibly change, because this, like your teeth, is perfect. It is Sunday. The first Sunday of my new life, and I am wearing the dog collar you fastened around my neck. A new life stretches before me. It begins with the day of rest. I lie back on a broad green leaf, and I watch the sun bursting in your womb. What a clabber and clatter it makes. All this expressly for me, what? If only you had a million suns in you. If only I could lie here forever, enjoying the celestial fireworks. I lie suspended over the surface of the moon. The world is in a womb-like trance. The inner and the outer ego are in equilibrium. You promised me so much that if I never come out of this, it will make no difference. It seems to me that it is exactly 25,960 years since I have been asleep in the black womb of sex. It seems to me that I slept perhaps 365 years too many. But at any rate, I am now in the right house, among the sixes, and what lies behind me is well, and what lies ahead is well. You come to me disguised as Venus, but you are Lilith, and I know it. My whole life is in the balance. I will enjoy the luxury of this for one day. Tomorrow I shall tip the scales. Tomorrow the equilibrium will be finished. If I ever find it again, it will be in the blood and not in the stars. It is well that you promise me so much. I need to be promised nearly everything, for I have lived in the shadow of the sun too long. I want light and chastity and a solar fire in the guts. I want to be deceived and disillusioned so that I may complete the upper triangle and not be continually flying off the planet into space. I believe everything you tell me, but I know also that it will all turn out differently. I take you as a star and a trap, as a stone to tip the scales, as a judge that is blindfolded, as a hole to fall into, as a path to walk, as a cross and an arrow. Up to the present, I traveled the opposite way of the sun. Henceforth, I travel two ways, as sun and as moon. Henceforth, I take on two sexes, two hemispheres, two skies, two sets of everything. Henceforth I shall be double-jointed and double-sexed. Everything that happens will happen twice. I shall be as a visitor to this earth, partaking of its blessings and carrying off its gifts. I shall neither serve nor be served. I shall seek the end in myself. I look out again at the sun, my first full gaze. It is blood red, and men are walking about on the rooftops. Everything above the horizon is clear to me. It is like Easter Sunday. Death is behind me, and birth too. I am going to live now among the life maladies. I am going to live the spiritual life of the pygmy, the secret life of the little man in the wilderness of the bush. Inner and outer have changed places. Equilibrium is no longer the goal. The scales must be destroyed. Let me hear you promise again all those sunny things you carry inside you. Let me try to believe for one day, while I rest in the open, that the sun brings good tidings. Let me rot in splendor while the sun bursts in your womb. I believe all your lies implicitly. I take you as the personification of evil, as the destroyer of the soul, as the Maharani of the night. Tack your womb up on my wall so that I may remember you. We must get going. Tomorrow. Tomorrow. September 1938, Villa Surat, Paris. This recording of Tropic of Capricorn by Henry Miller was produced and directed by Michael Conroy and performed by Campbell Scott. It was recorded at Harper Studio by Angela Paiva. It was edited by Fred Koch. Mixing and mastering were by Sharon Matlin. We hope you've enjoyed this program from Cadman. For more information about the broad range of titles from Harper Audio, Harper Children's Audio, and Cadman, please visit our website at harperaudio.com. Thank you for listening.